right, welcome everyone to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 181. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. With me today, Jonathan Lindemann.
Hey, hey, hey.
Hey, hey, hey.
Greg Lay.
Hoy, hoy.
And James Jones.
Hey.
Fat Albert always catches him off guard.
Despite the tone of James's voice there, he's actually very happy that he's getting his Xbox back in a few days.
Yes.
So I'm happy for you, man.
It's called How Loud Can You Yell Before Somebody Pays Attention?
Yeah, pretty much. Now, I guess the key was that advocate thing.
The advocate email address. Big thumbs up to our forums for finding that guy.
Yeah, although it is pretty funny they have an actual second tier of support because their first tier of support
their
is
primary
so
tier
bad.
Is so
you think they'd be pretty well practiced at this stuff by now,
yeah.
Wouldn't you?
Yeah, so another update for the listeners here is that our retroactive poll is over, and a lot of you voted. And the next game that we're going to be playing for this feature is Super Mario RPG. I think it's a game that all four of us have played to some extent before, either years ago or on Virtual Console, where it came out last year. So
I played it back in my 30s.
Ooh, those heavy
there you
days.
Go.
It was
there
actually maybe it was 2008 now. It was longer ago than last year.
Well, I for one played not that far into it on Virtual Console, although I'd almost beaten it on cartridge a long time ago. So yeah, it's a long game, and I think the current plan is that we're probably going to discuss this on the show in 2 or 3 weeks, so we're going to give ourselves a nice little buffer here to play deep into the game, since, you know, most of our listeners are probably already familiar with Super Mario RPG. We think it's probably the best use of our time on this game is probably to talk about it in depth, to talk about some of the things that happen later in the game, or at least to talk about the game overall from beginning to much later into it, rather than just kind of go over the first couple hours like we often do with retroactive. So I hope you will also take the time to play pretty far into it, especially if you like it. And the way retroactive works is that it's, you know, very heavily dependent on input from the listeners. So as you're playing the game and you collect your thoughts, you make comments, you want to compare it to other stuff, you know, you want to kind of wonder why did they do it this way or what's going on with this? Isn't it weird that Square is using Mario characters? Post that in the retroactive forum thread, which will be created by the time you hear this, and you know, we'll get really good discussions going, hopefully, with everybody who's playing along, including us, and all the other listeners who are playing along, and then, of course, we will be extracting quotes out of that to read on the show while we discuss the game, and to help guide our conversation and discussion into interesting little nooks and crannies. So looking forward to it. I hope you are, too. That's Super Mario RPG, and we'll be talking about it soon. Now on to new business, and James is going first.
So I've got, as I mentioned last week, I've actually got some time invested in Tales of Symphonia, Dawn of the New World. And when TYP was on here, when I first mentioned having bought it, he was pretty harsh. let me rephrase that. He was really harsh. And all I can say about the game is I forgot how brutal that the original game can be sometimes with things like boss battles. Where it's like, yeah, you're fine in the dungeon, but fuck you, son, and just completely wipe you out in about 5 seconds.
I don't remember that being a problem.
As I've had this, I realized there were some boss battles where the game just said, eh, you know what, bang, we're done.
Yeah, I don't really like that with some RPGs I've played, like walking into the buzzsaw kind of thing, because
yeah.
It's like, you know, when you go through a dungeon, you start to get a feel for, like, you know, have I been leveling up enough or not?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, especially if you've got something like a Chrono Trigger with avoidable battles, it's like,
yes.
Well, you know, should I avoid these or shouldn't I? Because, you know, am I too weak at this point?
There's
or,
a cost benefit
enough?
Going
and
on.
And if
there.
That doesn't meet up with the bosses, so, you know, if the bosses are just this massive spike that there's no relation to what's been going on, then that whole process that I find really helpful in playing RPGs kind of doesn't really apply.
Well, it's funny because I'm only about 3 or 4 dungeons in now, because, I mean, it's a long game, and, you know, time's not always available during the week to play an RPG, because you don't want to play it for 5 minutes and put it down.
That's true.
I find it difficult to play on non-portables in general, to be honest, RPGs.
It's kind of hard to get really moving. So when you run into, like, a buzzsaw boss and you have to go back a certain amount of time, it's really a lot more frustrating than it would be when you have a lot of free time on your hands.
Just kills the momentum.
Yeah, it really just makes me turn the game off.
So, James, I mean, even though you're early in the game, I'm sure you've you're getting a grasp for, you know, how everything works. I mean,
yeah.
And you played the first Tales of Symphonia, so can you explain, you know, what have they really changed or what have they improved in the Wii sequel? Because Dawn of the New World, it just seems like it came and went.
Yeah.
And I liked the first Symphonia, but maybe it was just the first couple things I read from TYP, but just I never really took any interest in the sequel.
I mean, it's basically the same game. And appreciably, there's very little change in the game. The primary exception, of course, is that because there's, generally speaking, only two characters, at least up to this point, you can fill the rest of the game with the animals that you kill. So, or not kill, I guess, because obviously they can't join your team if you've killed them. But when you beat someone in battle, sometimes you get the opportunity to try to convince them to come join you. I think you can have four. And as you pile these guys up, you can actually cause them to, basically as you get them, your ability to use them increases. So the more you actually get to join you, the stronger you become.
So there's almost a Pokemon element to it?
A little bit, yeah. And they kind of flush out the rest of the battlefield for you. And it's just like in the original game, the battlefield is 3D, but you're running on 2D planes, and three of the allies are computer-controlled, and you're controlling the hero. And it's kind of nice to have, you know, these monsters doing the fighting for you, because they're the ones I have are physical brutes, so I can kind of step back and let them do work while I just kind of manage things. But I mean, the game doesn't do anything particularly new. I mean, besides that, it seems like it's pretty much just Tales of Symphonia with a character swap. And in fact, a lot of the characters from the original game have already made cameos. And it's basically just like, hey, look, remember this person? You saw this person in the last game. Remember this city? You were here before.
So the graphic style has been changed a little bit, though, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's not quite as cel-shaded as it was before.
Is that an improvement?
I'm not sure if it's an improvement or a disservice to the art style. But you have to understand, I'm also playing it on a much better visual setup, too, so it's hard for me to be a really solid judge of that.
Right.
It does look very nice, though, especially on the big TV.
Cool.
I don't know. I mean, I'm enjoying it. It's not quite as horrible for the first 4 hours as TYP made it sound. but he really was right. They don't explain the animal capturing system that well. They kind of give you like some pointers on it, and then all of a sudden one day you're told, hey, you can't catch anymore, and you're like, well, why the fuck not? And you realize you only have a certain number of slots available, or there's elements, but they don't really explain what the elements do, so suddenly you've got, okay, well, what's strong against this guy? I don't know, because they didn't bother to tell me.
So the four-hour tutorial is inadequate.
Yeah.
That was TYP's contention.
Yeah, it is. But it's not like a Kingdom Hearts 2 kind of tutorial, where you're playing a completely worthless second character who's not really the main story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's done in the form of the story. So yeah. It's not completely insane. I don't know. I mean, I'm still trying to figure this game out, so.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. I also got for review, let me make sure I get the name right, Glory of Heracles, which is Nintendo DS title,
hold
published
on,
by Nintendo.
RPG Double Dip.
I haven't really got much time into it yet, but it looks nice. That's just all I can say so far, is that it visually looks nice. But the back cover is horrifying. I'm just going to go ahead and click.
Why?
Bear that in mind, everyone.
There are character designs on here that just look silly, so I'm a little
nervous.
You're
taking it to the counter at GameStop. Do not turn it over.
Just keep it keep it flat.
Yeah.
Put it back down first.
Well, no, I just pointed that out because there's all these characters I haven't met yet, and they all look ridiculous. And in some cases, more ridiculous than others, so I'm looking forward to this.
I do like the disconnect sometimes. Like Final Fantasy IV is quite good for that. In terms of the,
yeah,
like, because they're kind of a bit chibi-ish
yeah.
in the game, but then, like, on the back, they're completely sort of normal proportions.
Final Fantasy's famous for that, because for the first, well, I mean, Amano did the character sketches for a long time. I'm not sure if he still does it, but
I don't
at least
so.
Up until 10 or 11, this guy named Amano did all the character art, but he only did the sketches that then the sprite artists, the pixel art guys, would kind of base the super deformed characters on the sort of realistic, very romantic looking, gothic almost, characters that Amano had drawn. And there was always a strange disconnect. And it's weird that, you know, when Final Fantasy VII came out, people complained that the game had like four different character design styles.
At least.
It was just randomly flip between based on what screen you were on. And I guess it didn't shock me that much when I was playing Final Fantasy VII because I was a fan of the previous games and I was always used to this disconnect. Even in Final Fantasy VI, for instance, you can, whenever you go to the menu screen on the overworld, you know, you get these miniature character portraits of all your characters and they don't look anything like the actual character art when you're playing the game. Because the portraits that you get are based on Amano's work. And the super deformed battle graphics are most certainly not. So you've always really had this weird disconnect. And I don't know, when I was a kid, it wasn't that hard for me to bridge the gap between the two. Like, it just, my imagination just kind of said, okay, well, if we could zoom in on these super deformed guys in battle, and you could see it in, like, really high resolution, nice graphics, it would look kind of like the Amano character art, right? You know, it's just, as nope. I don't know, when I was younger, it was easy to make that connection. And so the disconnect didn't really exist for me. But I think as we get into more advanced graphics, you kind of expect all of these different looks at the characters to kind of match up and be more continuous now than they used to be.
That's one thing I'll say for Chrono Trigger. I'm not a big fan of the Toriyama art in general, but obviously they still have to do a significant kind of translation kind of process to get it to work as pixel art, but it does feel right, you know, it does feel connected.
Yeah, those characters really do look like Toriyama's artwork. And also the other thing is you also have the character portraits on the menu screens in Chrono Trigger, but they actually look like the characters on the screen. So they did a much better job of, you know, making those fit together in some kind of continuum.
But that's partly a product of the fact that he made simple character designs.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Sure. Much easier to display.
It works well that way.
James, I'm looking forward to hearing what you think of Gloria Heracles. Like I said last week, I'm interested in that game.
But... yeah, like I was only tangentially aware of the series up until now.
Well, it's never come to America before.
Right.
So, and also, I think this is the first game since the early 90s in that series. Like, there were several on Famicom and maybe one or two on Super Famicom, and then they took a really long break. So they're finally reviving it.
Well, because Data East went bankrupt.
It wasn't originally a Nintendo series?
No, Data East made it.
Wow, Data East. I didn't realize it had such a history.
Yeah. It's like the new Fire Emblem.
This is... Data East employees were hired by Payon to develop the game.
Oh, Payon, right. Yeah, the guys that did DK Jungle Climber or whatever.
Yeah, they also did DK Barrel Blast for Wii.
The Klonoa port for Wii, they did that.
Oh, that's true. Klonoa is a very, very good remake.
Well, I'm glad to see they have their RPG chops together.
I think the more important lesson here is that it seems like they're actually getting better with their output. Although, well, I guess the DK King of Swing was a pretty good start. I don't know of anything.
But that game got
at
least 2 points based on its name alone. DK King of Swing.
Yes. Anyway, Greg, what you been playing?
Well, so first of all, I suppose the only new thing I've got this week is I picked up Ratchet and Clank, A Crack in Time, which is the latest in the Ratchet games, the final part in this future trilogy or whatever. So I'm coming at the end. There's a little catch-up video when you boot it up or whatever, so you know what the story is, and that's sufficient for me. And I got it for a reasonable price, as always. I think I've yet to pay more than 50% of the retail price for any PS3 game that I've bought. So, PS3, the budget console at last.
Yeah, well, Ratchet and Clank fell pretty fast. I mean, that game's only a couple months old.
I think it was just a really good deal online. You know, if you're vigilant, you can hit this stuff up pretty quick. But yeah, I mean, like, I wouldn't expect to see Uncharted 2 hit that price anytime soon. No. But, you know, it probably did sell as well.
Is it like with the Xbox where, you know, my refusal to buy $50 games has been pretty easy because everything drops almost instantly?
Yeah, no, it is. It is. Yeah. It's the same dynamic here, especially with online retailers, apart from, you know, maybe a few select titles. And certainly, you know, the Nintendo stuff is a different arena. It is very different, the price dynamics there. But yeah, I picked it up because I saw it. Looked pretty cool. I played a demo for the first of the future trilogy and thought that was all right. And then this one's got some cool, like, time-freezing puzzles and stuff that sounds like it might be more interesting than,
Blinks.
Than the first one, so...
Blinks.
So, yeah, I thought I'd try it. I like Jet Force Gemini, which it does seem very similar to.
Blatant. Yes,
more than a little.
I've never played Ratchet & Clank for more than a few minutes, but I've always thought that it seems so derivative of other games I've played that it didn't seem to really have a whole lot of personality of its own.
Yeah, well, I mean, the one thing I'd say about the personality from what I've observed so far, it's very sort of polished cutscenes and voice work and all that. You know, it's not, like, incredibly witty, but it's witty enough, you know, it's humorous enough, and it's well done enough that it's, you know, that it does it great on you or anything. And probably the best thing about the game's personality so far is when you looking into upgrading your weapons, they have like this sort of information or commercial video for each one that is straight out of Ren and Stimpy. I mean, it's like, they very studiously sort of use that same tone and animation style. So it's kind of like those. Do you remember in Ren and Stimpy, they had the commercial for Log?
Yes.
Oh, fuck yes. It's big, it's heavy, it's wood.
Yeah, it rolls downstairs and all that stuff. It's basically that for ridiculous guns.
It's better than bad, it's good.
It's better than plastic, it's wood. It's Log from Blammer. So, yeah, that's basically what you're looking at. And that's pretty endearing. But in terms of the game, I haven't really got into it enough yet. I mean, it's the kind of thing that would seem like it would work well on Wii with pointer controls. Yeah. You know, for the shooting parts, but I'm not aware of anything that's that close to Ratchet being on Wii.
No,
I don't think so.
Not that I can think of, really. Like a very fast-paced third-person shooter, kind of cartoonish. And
yeah, maybe with a few platform elements as well. No, I'm not aware of that, and it seemed like it would be a good fit for the Wii market, so... Mm-hmm.
Sure, yeah.
More than 3 years in, anyone want to fill that?
Anybody, any third parties? Oh.
Anybody, any takers?
Actually, I've heard a pretty strong rumor that Insomniac, the developers of Ratchet & Clank, might be going multi-platform this year. And... Mm. I guess you could make an argument either way, but I think it's as likely as not that maybe they're looking at jumping into the Wii market, because certainly with Ratchet & Clank, I think they've shown that they are good at making the kind of game that would probably do really well on Wii.
Yeah, I mean, I think if they could partner up with Nintendo a bit, you know, in terms of, like, getting the promotion out there.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Just because it's kind of friendly to the Wii market doesn't make it a surefire hit. It's got it's got a track, you know, I mean, Zakawiki, in terms of its presentation, looks friendly enough. The game's
pretty
hard.
So, there's no guarantee, but... Yeah, you know, Insomniac has been independent always, and they've only made games for Sony for Sony platforms, I should say, for about the past 10 years, and Sony has published most of those.
Mm-hmm.
But there's really nothing to prevent them from making games on other systems, and I think, you know, Resistance 2 was not really all that big of a seller, and I think that was a major title for them. And then Ratchet & Clank, you know, the new one, the one that you're playing, Greg, I don't think it really made much of a sales impact on PS3, so...
It was overshadowed, wasn't it, by other big PS3 games, and, you know, it was quite a kind of tough conditions for it.
Yep.
Right, yeah, and so I've heard quite strongly that they may be moving out, and so this may actually be a relevant developer for Wii fans maybe by the end of the year. They really put games out every year like clockwork. They're very
I guess Resistance 3 is pretty much been confirmed by that thing where there was an advert for it in a film
There was a billboard in a film, I guess it was.
Yeah, so it's going done. To it will be advertised in a film yet to be released, basically.
Yes, and that's a Sony property, I'm pretty sure. But you know, Insomniac also has some experience doing download games. Like the second in the Ratchet and Clank series on PS3 was a download game for about $20, and so maybe they're going to. And that came out the same year as Resistance 2, so it could very well be that they're going to put something out this year, maybe on a different platform for download, and then next year really break it out.
Yeah, so yeah, I'll be looking forward to talking about more in depth about the game next week, because it seems promising so far.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very beautiful, and the frame rate is very smooth. I find 60 frames games that aren't racing games or Sin and Punishment are slightly unnerving. I don't know why.
It's almost too smooth.
It's just too smooth.
Yeah.
Yeah, I played the, I don't know why, I played the Dante's Inferno demo. I found it difficult to cope with. I was just kind of curious as to what the hell's going on. It's That is what the hell, that game.
Yeah.
That's what
I had a friend call me and say, dude, you really got to download that Dante's Inferno demo. But he said it in an unironic way, so I told him no thanks.
And the other thing about that demo that was weird is that there was too much rumble. Like, literally, the controller felt like he was going to fly out of my hands. So much for that last-gen tech stuff that they used to talk about. It'd be rumbling all over the place on PS3.
Well, it's probably with fire, right? There's probably fire everywhere, and every time you're near fire, it vibrates.
Yeah, I guess
they're
well-known.
Well, what it is, of course. You actually hit the resonant frequency of all the skulls that build up the walls and floor of that game, so it's causing everything else to vibrate around it.
Yeah, fire is well known for its vibration capacity.
Mm-hmm. In terms of what I was actually playing this week, there was a weird coincidence of factors. I actually finished four games within a few days of each other that I'd had on the go from various times, some of them bought quite a while ago. So, A Boy and His Blob, Killzone 2, Pixel Junk Shooter, and Dead Space Extraction. Dead Space, I guess, just to follow up on last week, reasonable ending, you know, fairly sort of happy with it. Oh, it didn't really change my opinion of the game overall, which was, you know, it was pretty fun, but I mean, I'm glad I didn't play all that much for it. You know, I think it's one of those things where it could have done more to make it more of a kind of essential kind of purchase type title, but I think it did drop the ball a little bit. So there was that. Although I noted there was a reference in the ending to The Sprawl, which has since, I don't think it was known at the time, but has since been revealed to be the location of the second game for the HD consoles.
Dead Space 2.
Yeah, Dead Space 2. So you're going to have, it's supposed to be like a space station that's like massive, like a city in space, basically, isn't it?
Mm. I mean, it sounds like the kind of environment that would work for Dead Space. I'm really curious to see what they do with Dead Space 2, because I don't think they can just give us a new environment to run around in.
No.
It's kind of like Resident Evil 4. When they made Resident Evil 5 and it's pretty much the same, a lot of people revolted at that. And I think the same will happen with Dead Space 2. I mean, even if it's just as good as the first one, that won't be enough. They really need to push it. So it'll be interesting to see how they try to do that.
What if there was co-op?
I mean, co-op, I love co-op in theory, but do you know how many games I've actually played through in co-op online? Zero.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, because the problem is, and like you, Greg, a lot of times I buy games a month or two or more after they originally come out.
And then it's difficult. And,
right. You know, preferably, especially co-op, you'd want to play with a friend. But for one thing, I don't have dozens and dozens and dozens of friends on my friends list on Xbox or PS3. And even the ones that do, you know, I have friends who are still playing Chromehounds and, you know, Project Sylphie, like Ty Sugar. So, you know, it's hard for me to end up with a co-op game that I want to play at the same time that someone else wants to play. And the thing about playing through a story mode or a kind of an adventure in co-op is that you can really kind of only experience that once. I mean, you know, there aren't that many single-player games that I would want to play through in their entirety again just to do it in co-op.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like the experience isn't going to be that much different for me to want to play through all that again. So it's hard to sync up, you know?
I don't say this to be sort of overly critical or anything, but I do think that co-op might be systematically one of the most overvalued components of games in the games media reviews, because obviously, they can play it together, and they probably play a lot of games together because they all work in an office where everyone's playing games, and
they all have
they're friends with a bunch of other people that are working in offices and playing games, or they're friends with developers.
And they all play the same games at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, it's their job.
Yeah, again, I mean, it's up to you when you read that in a review to kind of apply that to your circumstances, you know. So I'm not going to criticize them for that, but I think too heavily, but it's worth bearing in mind.
I think it's like multi-card DS games. You know, like, it may be one of the most fun things you've ever done, but it's so unlikely that you're gonna have a lot of opportunity to actually do that, that it ultimately isn't that important of a feature, even though it may be the best thing about the game. And that's how I feel about co-op. I mean, it probably is as great as everybody says, but, you know, I won't know.
You'll never use
it,
exactly.
It would take such an inordinate amount of effort for me to actually play it that way.
Well, I mean, Johnny, I mean, I pretty much have all the games that you have for 360, and how many times have we actually played co-op once? Or even played online in anything?
John's dodging.
And John, I do want to connect with you soon on some of these 360 games, because especially Modern Warfare 2, because I know we both have that, and mm-hmm. I really do want to play some of the co-op in there. And the reason that I'm really motivated to play the co-op in that game is that it's a separate mode with new levels and new missions, and it's actually right. a new experience, so I'm not going to feel like I'm repeating things I've already done
exactly.
just to do co-op.
Yep.
And of course, it's one of these titles that's a bit, you know, where it's one of these things that applies to DS games as well. You know, when it's so massive, then a lot of those problems are lesser. You know, like New Super Mario Bros. Wii. The fact is, when it's got that kind of appeal, it's just going to be a lot easier to get games with people, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, to finish off on some of these things, so I played all these endings in a row was kind of weird. I spent a lot of time looking at the credits. The Kill Zone 2 credits are incredibly long. My God, yeah. like Lord of the Rings or something. It goes on forever. Yeah. But they do start to run together. Like, I have this image in my mind of the boy feeding the blob bullets. And then him morphing into a moron named Rico. And I'm pretty sure that's not how either of those games ends, but I like the image anyway. But you know, it's weird because with game endings, like, I don't know, I don't think they're as important to how satisfying you find it as like maybe a movie might be, because it's not always about resolution so much. But I tend to find if it's a really good ending, it's just a big bonus.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a lot of games I love that kind of fall flat a bit at the end. Like Batman, I mentioned, I wasn't impressed with the ending of that. Or Castlevania 4 has got a bit of a limp ending and things like that. But then when you get something like Contra 3, I mean, I'll never forget the ending of that. It's brilliant. It's well worth suffering to get to the end.
I don't think I've ever seen it.
It's awesome. You owe it to yourself to see that. It's brilliant.
I don't know if I ever beat the boss where you're hanging from the missiles.
Oh, that's not that far from the end, is it? It's the last side-scrolling level before the final level, because there's another one of those rotatey overhead things, I think, after that, and then you play the final level, which is quite short until you get basically the boss parade. And the boss parade's awesome, and then the very final boss, which is kind of a boss parade in itself, is especially awesome. But yeah, I mean, it's just one of these things I've noticed, like a lot of games, they seem to feel pressure to make the length of the finale somehow proportional to the overall length of the game, mm-hmm. which means that RPGs always have absurdly long final bosses.
Yeah.
You know, or even like the Metroid stuff, like, you know, the finale to Metroid Prime 2, which I haven't actually reached yet. I'm closing in on it.
I mean, it's cool, but it's so long.
It's so bloody long. It's ridiculous. And even Prime 3's is really quite long, because the thing they do with that is it's not just like the boss fights. You can't save inside the planet of Phazon, so you have to do the whole damn
thing.
You have
to go all the way there, yeah.
There's a checkpoint at the beginning of the boss fight, but you can't save it. So if you switch the system off, you've got to do the whole trek through the planet again, which, I don't know, I know they're going for epic and wow, and this, but I don't know, sometimes I think less is more.
Well, speaking of games that I've heard have really wacky endings, I've been playing Silent Hill Shattered Memories on Wii. It was GameSpot's Wii Game of the Year for 2009. I don't know how it's going to fare in our Game of the Year, but I'm pretty impressed with it. You know, I was hesitant. I have to confess, I only rented it, so I apologize. I didn't rack up another sale for that game, and it certainly needs one. But you know, I feel justified in my trepidation in that I've never played a Silent Hill game. I generally don't like survival horror games that much. And Climax, you know, they're not even the original developers of this series, and their previous game, was it Homecoming, Silent Hill Homecoming, was not really that well received. So, you know, I had reason to be cautious with Shattered Memories, but it is really a pretty great game. It's interesting. It definitely doesn't feel like other survival horror games. It actually feels more like a horror game. Like, it feels kind of more like a horror movie. And there were even moments in the second chapter where you're walking through a forest that distinctly recalled Blair Witch Project, which for me is a very, very good thing. I know some people don't like that movie, but I really love that movie. I love the atmosphere that it creates. And Shattered Memories is very good at creating an atmosphere. And the sort of dangerous parts, the parts where you can actually die, where the world freezes over and these weird naked zombie guys kind of run at you, those parts are very much sequestered from the rest of the game. And so it is very clear, and I've heard this criticized a lot, it's very clear when you're in danger and when you're not. But for me, I would actually prefer to do without those sequences at all, because not only do I find them to be, you know, not really that scary and a little bit frustrating at times because it's easy to get lost and whatever, but I just don't really, I don't enjoy those parts nearly as much as the exploration. And that's really the primary part of the game where you're waving around the flashlight and you're walking around this creepy town. It's really just exploration. I mean, you're just looking for things, you're trying to figure out where to go next, you're seeing clues and you're calling random phone numbers, and you're seeing like weird flashbacks and, you know, strange ghostly things happen. And maybe this would be boring to some people, but I think I could play an entire game of just that. And the reason that it's so compelling to me is, first of all, it does create a pretty amazing atmosphere. I'm not really easily disturbed or creeped out, but as James mentioned before, there are a lot of things in the environment that don't really serve a purpose except to just creep you the fuck out, you know? Like, they're just not right. There are things that are just not right in this world, and you come across them pretty frequently, and the game really, it approaches, you know, sort of disturbances from a lot of different angles. So sometimes you read something that's just scrawled on the wall that really kind of just puts you off, you know? It's not scary, but it just makes you think, like, whoever wrote that has something wrong with them. And obviously that person is not hiding around the corner. It's not about a monster that's about to jump out at you, and it's not that you're learning more about some supervillain that you're eventually going to have to face. It's just that the world that you're in is not quite right. And I think it works on a subtle level. Well, sometimes it's not so subtle, but I think the overall effect is very subtle in the way that it kind of gets to you, you know, and it just makes you kind of uncomfortable playing it, but not so much that you want to stop.
Well, and the one thing I'd say about this whole idea of being kind of obviously safe when the world hasn't turned to ice is that at least you know you're not going to have to deal with these kinds of, you know, quote-unquote surprise scares, you know, the zombie dogs and the spring-loaded cats that come out at you, you know, that kind of stuff is just so done. It's really trite and not scary at all. And, you know, so in the case of it being kind of compartmentalized, at least you know you're not going to have to deal with that.
Right.
And, you know, I can live with that. I think that's a good
thing. And the funny thing is that not only do you not have these zombie dogs jumping through windows at the last second, but in Silent Hill Shattered Memories, the weirdest, the creepiest stuff in the world is actually denoted by this static coming out from the Wii Remote speaker. And so you can actually tell when you're getting close to something that's truly fucked. And what I found is that I find myself actually trying to find those things because they're almost like Easter eggs. I mean, again, they don't really help you in the game. I mean, they're just interesting, you know. They're like these things that the creators have dropped around the world that kind of flesh out the experience and flesh out this place that you're in and what's going on. And as you get close and you hear this noise and it gets louder and louder and louder, I feel myself very compelled to find the epicenter of that noise and to see what it is, even though I may not like what I see. So, in fact, I think it's the opposite in that, you know, when I know that something scary is around the corner, I actually want to go look around the corner to find it, even though I could totally bypass it if I wanted to. I could easily avoid it.
It almost makes the world seem more alive in a strange way.
Exactly.
In a game where probably everything's about death.
Yeah. The other thing I want to note is that the presentation is really, really impressive in Silent Hill. I think from screenshots, it's not really evident what works about the game's graphical display, but when you see it in action, the lighting and especially the shadows are among the best I've seen, certainly on the Wii. And even better is that the textures are probably among the best textures I've ever seen in any video game on any system. I mean, these are like Metroid Prime levels of detail, but kind of taken in the turn of, you know, what's supposed to be a realistic environment. So you walk into a school, and the walls are just plastered with signs and notes and graffiti and just everything that you would imagine would actually be there. And the great thing about Shattered Memories is that you don't go up to it and press a button to read it or anything like that. You just look at it. I mean, the textures are so clear, and all the signs and everything are properly proportioned so that when you go up to it and point your flashlight at it, you can just read it. And a lot of it is incidental stuff. It's exactly what you would expect to find in such a place. And then some of it is equally very disturbing and is meant to, is put there purely for atmosphere and to creep you out. And it makes you want to explore these environments, not to find some little doodad that you need to get to the next room, but just to see what's there. I mean, to really soak it all up and to, you know, to learn this place and to get a feel for what it means and for, you know, why it was put there. And the environments are so detailed that I'm just fascinated every time I walk into a room. And also knowing that there's no danger, that there's nothing about to jump out at me and attack me, it kind of gives me the freedom to do that patiently and to really soak in these details and enjoy them. So I'm loving that. And I think if you're the kind of person who likes to explore games and really look at all the little details like that, you're going to love Shattered Memories because they're just everywhere. They're really all over the place. It's a pretty spectacular presentation.
Yeah, I'm definitely interested in giving this a go, although it hasn't actually come out yet in Europe. I think it's going to be within about a week or so. It's soon.
Well, that's all I've got, and John is going to wrap up new business this week.
Yeah, just kind of a funny backlog story from my notorious backlog.
I kind of
got sucked into the hype, and I ordered Mass Effect 2.
Oh, come on, man. They're not just ordered Mass Effect 2. Full disclosure, please.
What do you mean, full disclosure? Yeah, I got Mass Effect 2.
How much you lined their pockets by buying the collector's edition?
Yeah, I got the collector's edition. It was
bastard.
Of course I did. Well, see, this is the way in my mind I said, well, okay, because I bought that for the first one. So there's no way I'm going to have a standard for Mass Effect 2 and a collector's.
That's just, right. That's just a regression.
You just made one mistake into two.
I could not fathom it. It just was not going to happen. I decided to take control of the future.
Discretionary
and I went ahead
spending.
I just pulled the trigger.
Once again, John single-handedly keeps the gaming industry afloat through tough times.
Exactly.
Is it propped up by your Modern Warfare 2 night vision goggles, or are those on a separate shelf?
No, those did not bring me in with their siren song. Fortunately. But yeah, so I decided that, you know, since I have Mass Effect 2, I might as well play through Mass Effect 1, right? So,
no.
A small matter of playing through Mass Effect 1.
Wait, hold on. Pause. So, you bought the premium edition of Mass Effect 1.
Word.
Mm-hmm. Shelved it. Mm-hmm. Then proceeded to buy the premium edition of Mass Effect 2, based on the flimsy premise that you had already bought the premium edition of the first game.
Even though you hadn't played it.
Even though you hadn't flimsy, played it.
Flimsy as it is, I have no regrets.
Oh, you should.
Okay. But, so I load up Mass Effect. So I did have a saved game on there.
No, so let's get this straight. You had put it in the disk drive before.
Yes, I have. And it's kind of an interesting, it was an interesting time capsule because...
Time capsule.
Well, I looked back at it and the date on it...
2 years ago and everyone else played it.
Well, the thing is, this game was released on, I think, November 20th, 2007. The date on my save game was November 27th, 2007.
Oh,
and
dear God.
What's even better than that is I had played an hour and 17 minutes of the game. So literally, I was probably playing something else at the time. I got that game in the mail, and I didn't play anything the whole week that it actually came out. I played it that weekend for probably about an hour and a half, literally put it on my shelf, and never touched it again for over 2 years.
I hate this game.
Well, that's understandable, you know, because back in holiday 2007, Galaxy was obviously coming out, so I suppose John had probably already got 120 stars by then.
Oh, yeah, because John invested heavily in that
well
game.
Well played, Leahy, well played. I think it was 2007. I think I might have been playing. I was probably playing Metroid Prime 3.
Well, anyway, what do you think of the first Mass Effect? I mean, I just played this recently, and I loved it.
The thing is, I tried because there was such a huge gap between when I, you know, I kind of wonder, that whole thing just sort of made me wonder why I didn't get into it.
Solid question.
And I think it has to do kind of with the world. I guess I just don't really like the kind of. World that has created Mass Effect. I just always feel like it's kind of, even though you go down to these, you know, alien planets and stuff, the world feels kind of sterile to me. I really don't get into these deck of the Star Trek Enterprise kind of thing.
Game set in space.
Yeah, in general, I just really think that even like something like Metroid Prime 3, right? That game, it's set in space, but you're always like running around sort of these kind of lush alien forests and stuff like that. And a game like that, I really gravitate towards, but stuff like Mass Effect, I really have to try to get into it because I'm just not into that kind of, you know, brushed steel sort of looking areas and worlds.
I can substantiate this, judging from John's PS3 trophy list, that he's probably played Dead Space for about half an hour.
It's like, I don't know what it is. I mean, it's...
You like space to be organic.
Yeah, I guess it's just, that would be the word.
John, do you think it's accurate to say that the world of Mass Effect kind of feels like Giuliani got his hands on Mos Eisley?
He's cleaned it up. No more hives of scum.
That's
kind of
how I feel about it. It's super diverse, and it's still seedy, but it's clean.
Yeah, it's very... Yeah, it's very clean. And it's, I don't know, I just don't like it. It doesn't really strike me, I don't know, it doesn't really strike me as realistic. It's not really engaging.
Well, John, I don't know how far you are now in Mass Effect, but I was sort of half with you when I first started it, but and half sort of attracted to the way the game looks.
Yeah.
But I think what you'll find is that much better than the way the game looks is the way the world is written and the characters are written.
Mm-hmm.
And what surprised me about Mass Effect, because I'm not really the kind of guy who gets into lore, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't learn Elvish when I read Tolkien, but playing Mass Effect, I found myself like listening to some of these logs where it's almost like an encyclopedia of all the different technologies and alien races and historical events that they develop for all the backstory of Mass Effect.
Yeah.
And I could just sit there for 30 minutes at a time and listen to those things. And I don't know, there's something about the writing and the way that they developed all this stuff together in a literature kind of a way,
mm-hmm,
that really appealed to me. And you might find that that works for you better than the visual presentation of it.
Yeah, well, what really surprised me is that kind of going through the logbook, I did the same thing where, you know, because when I played it for the cup of coffee that I played it for before, I really didn't take in. I mean, a lot of that game is actually having to just kind of go through and explore not the world, but like you said, the lore of it. And the first thing I thought is I'm really surprised that, you know, this hasn't been made into like some, you know, MMO kind of thing, because it has everything. It has, you know, you have the Turians and all these different, you know, races and wars that were fought hundreds of years ago and all of this kind of stuff, all of this backstory, huge backstory to the game, which is really, really impressive.
But, you know, backstory and MMOs don't really go hand in hand. I think Mass Effect works because it's a single player game. I mean, otherwise they can't really convey all of that stuff that they developed for it. Like, Mass Effect is the first game I played where I thought, I know there's a novel of it, and on the right day, I could possibly even pick up that novel and start to read it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the game feels like a novel in some ways, the way it's put together.
Well, yeah, I mean, they really go to, like something like Lord of the Rings, there is a lot of sort of peripheral stuff.
Mythology, culture.
Yes, exactly. So even though you're just kind of walking one path, it kind of shows you that there's a whole world around you that is actually going on.
Yeah, I hope you like it. I mean, especially since you've already bought the sequel.
Especially since you've already paid so much for both of them.
Right.
No. I mean, I'm not worried about not liking it. It was just interesting to me. I was like, okay, well, obviously this is a very, very high quality game. What is not bringing me in right off the bat?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, what you'd say, what's the difference between this and something like Killzone 2, which presumably you played straight through right away?
8 times.
Yeah. Probably the fact that it starts out kind of slow. It's a sort
sure.
of it's
it does.
You know, a lot of sort of what's going on here. It's the thing is it you there's a learning curve, definitely, and like you'll find that with a lot of RPGs, but I think with Mass Effect there's definitely kind of a learning curve. It's like a third-person shooter, but the controls are a little bit more awkward than a third-person shooter. So
yeah, I mean, they've really tightened that up, though, in the sequel, apparently.
Yeah.
It's funny, because I think the learning curve in Mass Effect is not so much learning the controls or learning how to play the game, but learning how to understand the story and what's going on. You know, because they throw you... It's kind of like picking up Dune. I don't want to put those on the same level, but the first time I read Dune... Or the first time I saw the movie first, the David Lynch movie, and the first time I saw it, I was like, what the fuck's going on? And it's so bizarre and alien. That...
Yeah, I mean, anything where you've got like all these different factions and a history, and then you've got consider all the like individuals within that, and they've got their own agendas. Yeah,
traitors and rogue.
It's dense,
yeah.
And you've got to try and find your place within mm-hmm. that world.
Right, they throw you mm-hmm. into the deep end, and at first it's difficult to figure out what's going on and where you are in all of that.
I mean, mm-hmm. for narratives in general, whether it be games or anything else, I would prefer that. I mean, instead of just some really brutally blatant expository mm-hmm. introduction that just sets it all out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd rather pick it up as I go.
But the funny contradiction for me is I cannot stand it when anime does that. I really hate anime where they throw you in with all these characters who already know each other and know what's going on, and they don't tell you anything. And maybe it's just the added layer of Japanese-ness and all the weird things that go into
the
anime.
High drama.
But when anime movies and series do that, I cannot stand it.
I mean, it's a fine line to walk, really, because, I mean, no matter how subtle or how high of an opinion you have of your audience, you know, there has to be exposition. Unless it's a David Lynch movie that isn't Dune.
Well, he uses narration instead of exposition.
Well, in the Dune movie, yeah, but not so much into like Lost Highway. But you've got to do it somehow, and I think it's done best when it's mixed in with, you know, sort of natural human conversations between characters rather than just essentially talking to the audience. And I mean, at the end of the day, doing that well just comes down to good writing.
There's an abundance of good writing in Mass Effect, I'll say that. So, well, before we finish up new business, we have one last little item to take care of
here. Damn right we do.
Oh, here we go.
I'm not sure how to approach it.
I think I should interview you guys, actually.
I think you should. Let me preface it, and then you can go at it. So, Voodoo, our cherished forum moderator, sent me a PM with an offer I couldn't refuse, basically.
Shouldn't refuse.
And said, what if I gift Muscle March to you and John and James and get you guys to talk about it for a couple of minutes on the show? And I said, well, if you want to buy us 3 copies of this $5 game, now granted, I don't want to open the floodgates here to all of our generous listeners. You can't get us to talk about just anything.
But it has to be awful.
And homoerotic.
Yes.
It was a combination of, let's say, the uniqueness.
Johnny, we don't want to blow our wad right off the bat here. Let's just say that.
I think you just did.
Oh, yes. But also, Muscle March is obviously it's a pretty simple game for WiiWare.
True.
It's not a huge burden on us to play it and talk about it. So it's not exactly Super Mario RPG.
It's not very long, but it does get quite hard.
No.
Oh, Greg, please, I don't know if I can keep talking in a serious voice.
Okay, so as unfortunately cross-region gifting is not possible, which is pretty lame, I have the opportunity to play the straight man here, to get the straight dope on Muscle.
Well, this game, somebody has to play the straight man.
I think this game proves that's not the case, John.
But the first thing I wanted to know about this originally came out in the arcade. So people have been playing it in public. Is the experience made better or worse in the privacy of your own
there
home?
There is some enhancement going on when you play this in the privacy of your own home, I think.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. I don't know. You'd probably get arrested if you were playing this in public.
Well, it's weird. I mean, the
Maybe
gestures
not in Japan.
That you're
I don't
doing,
know.
The gestures Japan. That you're doing are not in themselves obscene. I mean, any
no,
kind
no,
of...
the gestures I was doing were in fact obscene.
Oh, okay.
Johnny, please continue with your explanation of how the game actually works.
Well, actually, not important. In terms of, I've definitely never seen the arcade version. I would love to try it sometime, but I'm really curious as to how it works because this is Muscle March, although it is very entertaining, is a classic case of developers trying to make the Wii do something that it's not really designed to do. The game is all about the position of your character's arms as you run through holes in the wall, mm-hmm. and the Wii remote doesn't detect position.
Nope.
So the only way that you can make your character do what you want is by jerking the controllers up and
jerk
down.
Jerk it, huh?
And
no.
I said that deliberately. But
good.
It's a classic case of a game that really would actually work with Motion Plus, but that's, you know, from a production standpoint, probably way beyond their ambitions for Muscle March. And the problem is, in terms of actual control, it's not responsive enough. It doesn't work the way it needs to in order for the game to actually work. But on a different level, the game works perfectly. So.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I mean, the thing is, I found that there's kind of like a sweet spot where you can basically hold the nunchuck and remote. And pretty much like you just hold them there the entire time. And when you have to push them down, you just move them down, up. Like it's almost like those guys on like the airport tarmacs that flag. That's what it reminds me of, or like some sort of flag game. That's it. It's like you really don't have to move your arms at all.
I can just do it with my wrists. Like if I have them like just below chest height.
Yeah, there's like 4 points, pretty much.
Yeah,
that's all it's doing.
Up, down, and you just go up, flip it up if you need to go up, and down if you need to go down.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, I mean, it's not quite sensitive enough to play
it's
at the faster
sensitive.
Speeds. But at the same time, it's like they overcompensated. Like, they didn't want you to accidentally move your arms up and down. But because of that, there's kind of a delay while the game interprets whether you really wanted to move your arms or not. And so when you get going at the really fast speed, which is kind of the objective as the game, is to get to the point where it's going so fast you can barely keep up. Mm-hmm. And that would be fine, except there's this inherent lag in the game interpreting your motion. And so it doesn't really move right when you move your arms. There's a delay, and that delay can mean all the difference. It's bad enough that I just wonder if it's even possible to play it perfectly, or if you get to a point where you just have to guess what the next position is.
Well, it's the same pattern over and over again, so I guess in theory you could memorize it. But if you've played that game enough times to memorize it, something bad is going to happen to your mind.
All I want to know is, where does the polar bear fit into all this?
Well, it fits in between Pedroso and... I can't remember what the female character's name is.
Brenda. Oh, Brenda. Yeah, she's terrifying. She's really scary. She's exactly the same model as one of the other male characters, except she's in pink and she has pigtails.
And she's wearing a bikini.
Exactly the same.
I always pick Pedroso because, as we're reminded by the game, he is a gentleman.
You know, the character select screen alone is worth $5.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It really is.
The whole thing. I mean, have you seen, did you play all the way through to beat the first part where, like, you play through the first three, and then that's the end of the game. I mean, the ending of that where the guys do the dance at the end, and it's like,
I haven't seen that yet.
Oh, dude, play through. It's worth
my
it.
I'll go back to it, but my favorite part so far is that the goal of the game is that you're running after this guy who's, you know, breaking through walls in a specific kind of pose.
With your protein.
The guy has stolen protein.
Yes.
That's right. Or steroids or something.
Why is it always protein?
I don't know, man. It's...
Well, you know, it's protein. So you gotta keep that in mind.
So it's basically a version of Hole in the Wall, except you're moving instead of the wall.
No, it is. It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's human Tetris, basically. But I love when you finally catch up to the thief, and you have to, like, rapidly shake the controllers in order to speed up so that you actually catch up with them.
Yeah, the takedown.
You tackle the thief, and then all of the other characters who previously dropped out, they come and they do a pile on.
Yep.
So you've jumped and tackled the thief, and then all these other bodybuilders jump on top of you until there's like a stack of like six guys.
A stack
on
of man
top
flesh.
Of this thief. It's hilarious.
My favorite is always the, I don't know if he's supposed to be God or whatever, but the character holding the giant hammer that just occasionally berates you if you lose.
Yeah, oh, with the guy with the white beard.
It sounds like the sequel to Hercules in New York that I've always wanted.
See, I would put it more as like, it's like the mutated love child of Choaniki and Katamari Damacy.
Yeah, and when I first turned it on, my first thought was, you know, it's very much like WarioWare. It has that kind of feel to it, like where it's just all just goofy Japanese weird cartoony stuff.
But yeah, it's a lot
real campy though. Yeah, it's a lot.
It's way crazier.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because when I first started playing the game, I think I just was just stunned. There was about two or three levels before I could really make sense of what the hell just happened. Mm-hmm. And then I got my ass completely handed to me in the third stage, which is the game goes difficulty level goes way up.
Yeah,
it does. When you get to the guy on the hoverboard, it becomes extremely difficult.
The alien on the hoverboard, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, no, this is the blue guy. What's it called?
The blue guy,
Mech Muscle is the last guy.
Mech Muscle!
Yeah. But I would encourage you guys, if you haven't noticed this before, I mean, the game has some pretty wacky Japanese music.
Yes.
And when the stage begins, make sure you look at the title of the song shows up on the screen, because these songs have the best names.
one of them is called like Muscle Passion or something. But by the way, have you played through all the different stages?
Cause I did, yeah.
My personal favorite set of foes is the two bunny rabbits where one's riding the other one's ass.
Yeah, no, I like those because the guy on the back who's actually doing his arms is an orange, so he's easier to see.
Yes, he is.
Which is really important. You have to be able to see the pose that the guy in the front's doing, which is hard because a lot of times you have two or three other bodybuilders who are in between you and the thief.
Yes.
We probably can't. There's not that much more to say about Muscle March, so
I think there is.
No, there's one other thing I would like to talk about, okay. and that is Endless Rush Mode. Have you played that?
I haven't tried that.
Try Endless Rush Mode. The funniest thing about it, and again, this kind of goes back to, I just kind of wonder what the whole deal is in Japan with muscle bodybuilders And the funniest thing about it is, it's, I mean, all you're trying to do is you're just trying to go as far as you can, just run through as many walls as you can, right?
Mm-hmm. I think it's going faster and faster.
Yeah, but you're doing it on a rainbow.
Yes.
Why a rainbow, Johnny?
Yes.
Why? Why a rainbow?
Rainbows make people happy.
Yeah. It's a rainbow, but there's just walls in the middle of it for no discernible reason whatsoever.
But why?
Remember, John, a rainbow is a promise from God.
I suppose we should be grateful it's an endless mode, so we'll never actually get to see the what's in the pot of gold at the end of that particular rainbow.
Right.
Let me tell you, because of this game, I don't think I'll ever look at Rainbow Road and Mario Kart quite the same way again.
But see, the best part of that is there's just so much crap on the side of the rainbow, but once it gets going fast, you can't look at it because you'll lose.
But it's a good game to have a spectator, because it's kind of like Katamari, where there's so much crazy shit going on that while you're playing, you can't really focus on.
Yeah.
And it's nice to have somebody there just laughing at everything on the sides. Although, well, actually, on my TV, the things on the sides are bars, because there's no widescreen support.
Yeah, there's just these two bars.
Which is really a shame. I wish they could cram even more wackiness onto the widescreen, but
I'm not sure that we could handle much more wackiness.
Yeah, probably they just not. Put bars on there. It's too bad. I don't know about you guys. I'm ready for a break, but I do sincerely thank Voodoo for sponsoring this discussion of Muscle March.
Muscle March brought to you by Voodoo.
Yes, and Voodoo, I hope it's everything that you hoped for. So with that, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll have a listener mail. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. Well, this week on Nintendo World Report, we start with some events coverage of a Tatsunoko vs. Capcom event in New York City. Neil and Lauren were both there, and they actually did an interview with the producer of Tatsunoko vs. Capcom, Ryota Nitsuma. The interview is pretty short, but very interesting, and among other things, Nitsuma said that he'd love to work with Nintendo or Square Enix in the future on a versus fighting game.
Yeah, so if you want to beat up Bowser Jr. with Ryu, buy Tatsunoko vs. Capcom.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, and for impressions this week, we have PokéPark Wii by Matt Blunden. And it has Pikachu roaming around, I guess, a Pokemon theme park, helping other Pokemon complete tasks, build new rides, and then you can play them as mini games. So from what Matt says, it's actually, he called it the most visually impressive Pokemon game that he's seen to date.
A dubious honor.
Yeah, well.
It sounds like Captain Rainbow of Pokemon. Just walk around helping people.
And Matt imported that from Japan, right?
Mm-hmm. Correct, it's not out over here.
We have impressions from Neil over DecaSports DS, and he notes that wall climbing is easy to play, difficult to master. It's sort of like a rhythm game, and it's got six-player, single-card multiplayer in golf, clay shooting, cheerleading, skydiving.
Sports there.
We're really pushing the boundaries of sports here.
The staff blog this week has James recounting his Xbox repair nightmare in forensic detail. So go there and experience the very well articulated rage for yourself. And there's another new episode of Radio Trivia Podcast Edition, this time featuring Zach Miller.
That's a good episode, and it has a lot of 8-bit music, which is kind of nice.
Yes, it does.
Okay, well, that's it for this week. Please check out NintendoWorldReport.com as soon as you're finished with the podcast, or even before that. You can do both at the same time. Alright, we are back, and as has been our practice lately, we're going to kick off segment 2 with Games of the Decade. And this week, we actually have a quadruplet of portable games for you. We'll start with Jared Rosenberg talking about WarioWare.
In 2003, Nintendo released the wonderfully inventive WarioWare Mega Micro Games, which is without a doubt my favorite game of the past decade. There are a lot of things to love in the game, zany micro games, which only last 5 seconds, really even less than 5 seconds, catching a piece of toast as it pops out of a toaster, dropping eye drops in a drowsy woman's eyes. It's these kind of quirky details that made it not laugh out loud funny, but just extremely humorous. But that's not enough to qualify for Game of the Decade. You see, in a decade of short attention spans and instant gratification with people using Facebook and Twitter and all these things, I feel WarioWare Mega Micro Games is Nintendo's best demonstration of what's happened to people in this decade. People can pick up WarioWare Mega Micro Games and play it for 3 minutes and have an amazingly enjoyable time. I feel this is a game that, for the next 1,000 years, people will be able to enjoy it. So they'll be emulating it on virtual reality devices, not like Virtual Boy 4, and just having the most wonderful time possible. It really is a game that will forever be loved. WarioWare Mega Micro Games, Game of the Decade. Oh, and it has the Fly Swatter game from Mario Paint. How can it not be the Game of the Decade?
The next one is going to be Phantom Hourglass from Matt Walker.
When NWR announced to its staff that there would be voting for Game of the Decade, I knew what my candidate would be right off the bat. The Legend of Zelda, Phantom Hourglass. Phantom Hourglass was released in Japan in June of 2007, and in the West in October. It was generally well-received among critics, receiving Game of the Year awards from IGN, GameSpy, and GameSpot, and receiving as much as a 90% aggregated score on Metacritic, and having sold over 4 million copies before it had even been out for a whole year as of March 2008. Its fine implementation utilizing the unique features to the DS that makes Phantom Hourglass the outstanding game that it is. It uses the DS's dual screens and touchscreen input to help give the seasoned Zelda fan a totally new experience while keeping it feeling every bit as Zelda game as its predecessors. The game controls completely using the touchscreen, something that is often used as an argument against it by those who prefer traditional play controls. While I acknowledge that many game designs lend themselves much better to a traditional game controller, I firmly believe that, similar to using well-implemented motion controls, the touch control in Phantom Hourglass provides the user with a more visceral experience than a conventional controller could ever accomplish. I argue that this kind of fun and immersion would simply not be possible by relegating all of Link's actions to a D-pad and buttons. The other main gripe players have regarding Phantom Hourglass's game design is its use of a central dungeon that the player must traverse several times in the course of the game in order to proceed. I, however, found this to be the opposite of monotonous. I rather enjoyed going back through that dungeon due to finding the shortcuts that become available to the player upon re-entering the dungeon with a new item, leading to a thrilling sense of discovery. I personally think that, just like the other games in the Zelda franchise spanning all the way back to the original NES, this game will still hold incredible value in the future. Continuing through the 2010s due to its control implementation as well as the inherent fun that comes from the wonderful adventure game design that the minds of Nintendo have delivered to its fans. And it's that winning combination of design, control, graphics, and sound that made Phantom Hourglass the best game of the decade.
Matt Walker sounds like a secret agent when he talks.
He really does.
My first thought was either it's the static or this is Stan Ferguson.
They have similar voices, actually. But yeah, the next game is going to be Metroid Zero Mission for Game Boy Advance, and it's from our own Greg Lee.
The Metroid franchise experienced a great revival in the 2000s, and the high point of that renaissance is undoubtedly a strong candidate for the Game of the Decade. But are you sure it's the title you may be thinking of? While Retro Studios spent the past 10 years bringing Metroid into the third dimension with tremendous success, Samus' creators at Nintendo R&D 1 perfected the classic Super Metroid template with Metroid Zero Mission for the GBA in 2004. Taking the original Metroid as its premise, Zero Mission retold the story of Samus' first adventure with completely revamped gameplay and graphics, which improved on those of its portable predecessor Metroid Fusion by leaps and bounds. A striking comic book-like aesthetic brought flashes of bright colour to the black depths of Zebes, but retained the essence of the iconic Metroid look established on the NES, while Samus and her many opponents were drawn with a flair never before seen in the series. For the game's design, Zero Mission reinterpreted the maps of the original Metroid through the prism of its brilliant successor, Super Metroid, resulting in an intricate, organic world that fit together ingeniously. Samus could now use many abilities drawn from later games in the series to explore these familiar landscapes, but where Zero Mission truly superseded its franchise brethren was in its perfectly responsive controls and blazing fast gameplay, which made the series' trademark retraversal a joy instead of a chore. Zero Mission's crisp pace did make for a brief first playthrough, but this Metroid was built for replayability like no other, with abundant opportunities for secrets breaking and collecting cleverly hidden items, unlocking several different endings, if indeed any encouragement was needed to replay the game beyond its supreme playability and atmosphere. There are yet more outstanding aspects of Zero Mission to commend it as the game of the decade: its return to minimalist storytelling, the memorable epilogue sequence. But perhaps no more needs to be said than this, the abstract from Jonathan Metz's Nintendo World Report review. The first Metroid is now the best.
Wow, I'm honored. So the last game this week is going to be Mario & Luigi Superstar Saga, as read by TYP.
Hey, TYP here again. This time I'm going to talk about Mario & Luigi Superstar Saga for the Game Boy Advance. Mario & Luigi was one of the most memorable games of the 2000s because it was more than just another Mario spin-off. With Yoshihiko Maekawa as director and music by Yoko Shimomura, it was a true successor to Super Mario RPG that fans had been clamoring for years. Alpha Dream seemed to come out of nowhere and captured the spirit of Mario and RPGs in a brilliant new way. It exemplified Nintendo's localization talents through inside jokes for Nintendo fans, as well as just funny new characters, their illusions and cameo appearances of old baddies and a bunch of new stuff as well. Of course, Luigi was back in a big way as Mario's Fraidy Cat sidekick. Completely missing from Super Mario RPG, this added a whole new dynamic between the brothers and the little shtick as they interacted with the various non-player characters. Of course, most memorable is Fawful and his unique style of communication.
Yeah, I have fury!
But there were other humorous things too, such as Mario and Luigi's vaguely disturbing hand powers, and things like Luigi having to dress up and drag. Amazingly, Mario and Luigi had a global release in November of 2003, released in Japan, Europe, and North America, literally within days of each other. But it was more than just the presentation and story. Mario & Luigi had a compelling new gameplay style that was built on Super Mario RPG's roots. It introduced a more refined timing mechanic. There was always something interesting happening during battle. Maybe there were some funny animations, or maybe it was just having to pay attention to Mario & Luigi in turn. Indeed, Mario & Luigi rewarded players for paying attention in RPG, something that really isn't true of many games in the genre. If you learn patterns, you could reduce your damage taken, and you could make battles go faster. This made grinding a non-issue so that you could just enjoy playing through the game and enjoying all of its bizarre experiences. Finally, Mario & Luigi is definitively a series from the 2000s, with entries released in 2003, 2005, and 2009, it was a strong presence in the handheld scene throughout the decade. And so that's why Mario & Luigi Superstar Saga is one of the best games of the decade.
Well, if nothing else, I think Mario & Luigi really ushered in a new era of localization success for Nintendo of America, and it's something that I never really considered one of their strong suits before that game, and it seems like ever since Mario & Luigi, they've been really good, and they're getting a lot of credit for it too, which is just weird. You know, you go back to the 90s and Nintendo localizations were not really that good. Mm-hmm. No one liked them that much.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, Super Mario RPGs was quite good, and then Paper Mario, so I guess it takes something of Mario RPG to sort of draw it out of them.
Paper Mario's okay, but, you know, Square probably localized Super Mario RPG.
Yeah.
They really had the talent back then to do that. I mean, that was part of their core business.
Yeah, they had to.
It was not for Nintendo in the
mid-90s. That's true, yeah. But, I mean, definitely there was a new level of, you know, wit and very tailored culture references and cleverly adapted things from that would have been in Japanese. I mean, it's absolutely one of the strengths of that game. Although, I mean, definitely a lot of what TYP says about the combat system, I found to be true. It was the first Mario RPG I played, and I was totally into it straight away, even though not being a RPG guy, because I really got into the pattern recognition aspect of it. I thought it just made it feel like a kind of more traditional boss fights, really. You're pretty old school in a way, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I really think that, you know, as fondly as I think of the original Super Mario RPG, I think that if this would have come along and I would have played this first, I probably would have remembered it just as fondly.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, obviously, you know, we'll discuss this more when we get Super Mario RPG on the Retroactive, but, I mean, this is so much more of a Mario game than an RPG that has some Mario dressings on it. I mean, it's not just the depth of the Mario franchise, you know, sort of references and in-jokes, which is definitely greater, but also the way they used it in terms of the game mechanics, you know, the exploration, the jumping, the hammers, the stuff with the brothers, all that stuff is really steeped in Mario. You've got to give it that.
Yeah, and I think the part that I always remember the best about Mario and Luigi is the hand powers that TYP alluded to. I kept thinking, this is the first time I can ever imagine a double entendre in a Nintendo game. And it's all over that part of the game. I mean, it's so dirty if you want to look at it that way. And it's like, and it's clearly intentional, but it's just shocking to see it in a Mario game. And on the same, you know, on the other hand, it's totally innocent and they easily got away with it. It's just like brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant the way they did it.
And it's so wonderfully silly. I mean, the whole premise is that it kind of, obviously, like most RPGs, you know, the initial threat is not the final threat, but you know, it starts off with the whole thing of that someone's nicked off with Princess Peach's voice and replaced it with bombs. Just like shows you exactly what that game's gonna be about from the get go.
Yeah, the first time I read that, I thought it was a mistranslation. And we finally saw a demo of it. I was like, wow, they really did replace her voice with bombs.
Brilliant.
All right, well, that's Game of the Decade, an ongoing feature, and you'll hear about a few more games next week. Until then, it's time for Listener Mail. James has the first letter.
Steven from Madison, Wisconsin writes, last year Nintendo released a series of games under the New Play Control label. Given your limitations regarding the lack of a vehicle to see Wii Motion Plus, do you think it would be a good idea for them to create a new line of releases called New Play Control Plus? Games that would include Wii Motion Plus unit. This way, players could get the accessory and a game at or perhaps even slightly below the cost of a standard Wii game. Do you think this would be a good idea? And if so, what games do you think would be good to use?
Yeah, see, that's the problem. I struggle to see what kind of games would really, you know, be sort of were designed in such a way that you could go back and apply Motion Plus Control, which, you know, is so much more sophisticated than the kind of stuff that's in the New Play Control games.
Yeah.
If it's actually going to be meaningful, if it's actually going to be worth having it be Motion Plus compatible, I can't see it. I mean, and also presumably, you know, would be a lot more work to kind of go back and make a Motion Plus scheme work than it would be to, like, oh, well, now instead of pressing Z on the top of the GameCube pad, you flick the remote or whatever, like, so this gesture stuff. I mean, it's just so much easier.
Well, going to the GameCube library, I think it's pretty difficult to find games that make sense just because those games were not designed for motion control at all.
Mm-hmm. No.
I think it's more interesting to go back and look at some of the early Wii games that could be now, you know,
enhanced,
theoretically remade for Wii Motion Plus. And unfortunately, I mean, this is a really cool idea, the idea of, like, New Play Control Plus. But going against the whole concept of re-releasing early Wii games with new Motion Plus support, which there's a precedent for doing that. I mean, Nintendo, they were Japan only, but Nintendo actually released Super Mario 64 and Wave Race 64 with Rumble Pack support in late 97, 98.
Yeah, after Star Fox, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah, and sure, and the obvious precedent with New Play Control, which they've already done. So, but, you know, like, the obvious candidates for adding Motion Plus to Wii games would be like Wii Sports, which has kind of already been done with Resort.
Yeah, because most of the games, or about half the games were in there.
Yeah. And Red Steel, which is kind of already being done with the sequel.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been at the very least amusing with that versus just funny.
And Muscle March.
Obviously. Yeah. Of course. But you'd need two controllers so you could dual wield.
Yep. Right. Hey, Samba de Amigo might actually work with Motion Plus.
Yeah, and I mean, you could do that more feasibly, because obviously, rhythm games get updates all the time, with different track lists or whatever, so. I guess his question is just did it? I don't know whether it did that well on Samba de Amigo when it came out. How well it has to do to be profitable is, whatever. I mean, it probably didn't have to go great guns, but I would have thought, Bessie, if you're reducing the audience down by leveraging it on Motion Plus, or maybe you could just have it as an additional mode, but yeah. This whole segment in the market thing is a tricky proposition. I mean,
part of Steven's question is that he suggests that they would actually pack in a Motion Plus, on the premise that Motion Plus is a fairly cheap accessory and it's fairly easy to include. And especially, if you're re-releasing a game that's already been out, then you can put the game itself out at a very low point, which means you can kind of include the Motion Plus and still come in under the normal MSRP.
So it's almost like something, it's like a Wii Play package, except with a better game.
Right.
With a game worth playing.
I might go for a Samba de Amigo re-release with a Motion Plus included for $40.
Mm-hmm.
They've already done it, obviously, with the thing is they've showed a willingness, unlike with, say, balance board stuff, where they will do third-party pack-ins, because, the EA stuff actually came first, to Grand Slam Tennis. And Tiger ended up launching their bundles and stuff before Wii Sports Resort because it got moved back. So, I mean, they're willing to do that, but, I mean, like I said, you're probably right. It's you're probably looking at a handful of Wii games getting sequels that are, maybe in some ways a bit like remakes rather than anything farther back.
With the amount of work that probably goes into adding Motion Plus support, it probably makes more sense to just do a sequel.
Right, because you're not going to be able to sell that game to everybody who bought the original, even if they are interested in the new control scheme.
Yeah.
Well, the hope would be that you could sell it to even more people who bought the original, because now, I guess the romanticism of this question, to me, is that you could actually fix games that were broken originally.
You
could,
but...
And there were certainly plenty of Wii games that were released basically in a broken state.
Yeah.
And... But none of those games really have the kind of mainstream appeal that could make
they were
this
broken.
Worthwhile. Samba de Amigo is, I mean, I love the Dreamcast version. I really do. It's silly, but it actually works as a rhythm game. It's fun. It's tight design. And the really sad thing about Wii is it's like this long-awaited revival of the series, and yet... At the time, the controller just could not do what they were asking it to do, and it just doesn't work. It feels wrong. And so not only did they pretty much preclude building a new audience for that game because the new version is so broken, but they really alienated all the old fans who had fond memories of it, who wanted a new version of it. And it's just like, I don't know if you can salvage something like that at this point.
I think the one thing they could make for a series like this would be they could port over Lair from the PS3 and actually give it controls that work.
Oh, damn,
PS3 controls plus.
Factor 5 basically doesn't exist anymore, so I don't know who would actually be in charge of that.
Yeah. Has there ever been a game where you could more single-handedly point to and be like, that really hurt this company?
Yeah,
to
really.
Death?
Well, anyway, it's an intriguing idea. It's a little bit difficult to identify games where it might actually make sense. Again, I don't think you would really want to bring over GameCube games that, they could do Mario Tennis again from GameCube and actually make the motion controls good this time. But that's probably an admission of failure that Nintendo is not prepared to make.
No. I mean, the biggest benefit of any of these new play control type releases is the pointer for older games, because that was the kind of thing that, plenty of games in that generation of consoles, PS2, Xbox and GameCube, you required you to steer around an analog stick. So it's not difficult to go in and put pointer, functionality, but that just makes it a lot more fluid and enjoyable to use. But in terms of the kind of stuff that Motion Plus provide, there is no, obvious translation like that.
So what you're saying is we need Little King story, new play control.
Yeah, well, maybe, I mean, it unfortunately doesn't seem like it's sold well enough to warrant a sequel, but...
Yeah, it's sad. That's a great game. Home. Well, Greg, you have the next question. Do it in an English accent.
Oh, yeah, let me work on that. I'll try not to sound like Don Cheadle. Adrian from Birmingham in the UK writes, do you believe, as I do, that gaming criticism needs to expand beyond reviews to a deeper form of critique in order to gain an improved reputation? Reviews can raise interesting questions concerning their subjects, but in the end, their purpose is simply to answer the question as to whether the product is good or not. Could an expansion in game criticism to encompass different questions and topics help us to change the current perception of games as a mere commodity or product? I suppose to sum up, my question is whether you think games' diminutive status in culture is a result of limited criticism or due to the games themselves. What should change, if anything, in the game industry's current relationship with those outside of it?
Ooh. That's a deep question.
Yeah, it is a deep question.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's valid from the point of view that game reviews are very focused on the product recommendation aspect.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of them are, but that's not necessary. They don't have
it isn't necessary, but that is the culture, and, you know, it's one of these self-sustaining situations, an equilibrium, because, you know, that's what a lot of people that read reviews expect, is what they want.
Yeah, that's what they want.
Yeah, you know, and then, you know, that drives traffic and whatnot, and then, you know, the sites want to give it to them. And that's fine. I mean, it is a very, you know, crude, the games, much more so than buying a movie ticket or an album or whatever, it's a lot of money to spend. So people, you know, especially given the tangible aspects of video games, you know, what works technically, what functionality it has, what modes it has, they want to know if their money is going to be well spent in a kind of, you know, hard and fast kind of way, more so than perhaps with some media. So I understand why it is the case, but I appreciate, as you say, John, it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah, I think for a lot of people it's not even so much the amount of money that's at stake when you buy a game, but the time that you have to put in to really experience it fully. And for a lot of people, you know, especially adults, you tend to have, you have a time budget that you're working with, and it's a matter of, well, which games are worthwhile? You know, I can spend $50 on a game. I can't spend 50 hours on that many games.
Yeah.
So that's one reason that I tend to be selective. But what I like about game criticism is not the part where they tell me whether I should get it or not, but why. Because that's really, you know, it gets down to the individual level at that point also. It's like, well, I know what I'm interested in. So if you're going to tell me, if you're going to recommend a game to me or vice versa, then, you know, the interesting part of it to me is why. And I really want reviews to get to that. And as long as they do, I'm okay with a recommendation. But you know, when I was running the site, when I was acting as reviews editor, and even now, I always recommend to people who write game reviews that it's fine to put in, you know, in the conclusion, well, I think you should buy this game, or I think this kind of person might like this game, or I think people like me might like this game. That's fine, but that's not a complete review. You know, that's something you can throw in Twitter. A review is a criticism. And you have to get on a deeper level, and you have to really talk about the game. You have to pull it apart and put it back together.
And that's that way the person themselves is better able to actually make their own decision about whether they should buy it rather than just take your word for it. You know, I mean, obviously, you know, you're always sort of acting on putting a certain amount of faith in the reviewer's ability to analyze it sort of, you know, fairly and in some detail. But, you know, if they can argue a case that's convincing, it's a lot easier for someone to make a purchase decision there. But I think in terms of explaining why you should buy it or not, there are some reasons that fall very nicely into the product recommendation capacity of a review. Like I said, like, you know, number of hours, number of modes, you know, the production values, or all this sort of thing. And those do tend to be the things that are emphasized in game reviews. So some of the things that are less obvious are, yeah, but something like, say, Silent Hill Shattered Memory, some of the things that tries to do, those sorts of things that don't tend to get as emphasized in game criticism, you know, whether it would be, you know, the kind of the atmosphere or the kind of emotional aspect, you know, the emotional responses try to draw from you.
Well,
I guess some of it's more difficult to write about.
The sad thing is, a lot of times it does get written about, it doesn't necessarily get read about.
Yeah, I mean, like, a lot of reviews are more quantitative than qualitative.
Yeah, but I think even when good reviewers take the time to really expound upon those more subtle virtues of a game and really try to get into artistic criticism of what they're playing and what, you know, a potential player would expect, a lot of people just skip over that and get to the end, and it's really sad. Mm-hmm. I mean, you probably wouldn't do that with a movie review, even though the movie is at most a 2-hour investment. If you're going to be playing a game for 20, 30 hours, I would think you'd like to know what happens in the middle, you know, like what is that overall experience like?
And well, yeah,
you're not going to get that from the last paragraph.
I don't think the games have really taken that step yet to most people thinking that they are worthy of being pulled apart by critics. You know, I mean, they're still kind of, I think a lot of times people are still kind of caught back in the 80s arcades where, you know, Pac-Man. Okay, well, is it a fun game? Yes, no. What would you give it out of 10? I'd give it an 8.
What is there to say about it?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, there is this kind of this quantitative dominance, this paradigm of quantitative. You know, people just skipping to look at the score or whatever. You know, and it's like I said, it's as much on the side of the game's consumers as it is on the media that's supplying it to them. It is an equilibrium. I wouldn't really like to attribute blame to one or the other. It's just kind of grown out of a time where games, you know, were very, very sort of about their technical aspects, and certainly, you know, had developed to the point where they'd have intricate narratives or this, that, and the other. So I can understand why it is the case. I guess the question would be, you know, at what point is that, you know, going to cease to be the case? I mean, I think it's just probably going to be a slow evolution, really, where over time gamers' expectations change, and then how their sort of service will change accordingly.
I would even say it might be a lateral movement away from the review format, because and I love reviews, I really do. I love writing them, I love reading them, and it's sad to me that they've been pigeonholed the way they have been in games media. But seeing as the state of it is what it is, you know, I think a lot of movement in actual games criticism has sidestepped reviews and moved into features, blogs, and podcasts.
Postmortems.
I mean, if all we did was recommend games on this show, it would be 5 minutes long. And we obviously don't do that. So there is a space where you can talk about games and you can even discuss games in depth. And it's not just a poll on a forum. And it's not just a number that you can crank into Metacritic. There's an actual conversation going on here. And we've shown that there are a lot of people who actually want to hear that. So, I mean, I think if you're listening to this show, you're proof that there is a space for real games criticism to exist. We don't have to put a score on it when we do the podcast, and maybe that really frees us up to do it the way that we think it should be done.
In terms of the current situation, you've seen it where, you know, certain outlets might have thought about, you know, oh, let's not do scores anymore, or let's do this, then, and it's like, no, we don't want you to do that because traffic's going to go down or sales.
Well, and furthermore, what's even worse is that sites will just assign your review a score regardless.
Nowadays it's like you can say you're not giving it a score, but
it will get scored
and give it one.
if it sounds like an 8 out of 10,
you can nice. Kick and scream, but it's gonna happen.
I think you're a lot better off just calling it something other than review, and then you dash those expectations, and it really just unshackles you to do it the way you think it should be done.
I think there's a lot of positives to the idea of, you know, the more persistent kind of evaluation of a game over time, because, as you know, they are often quite long, and so these reviews, you know, are kind of not necessarily all that representative of the experience as gamers will have it, because they'll probably, you know, might play a 50-hour game over a period of months rather than, you know, just burning through it for a deadline. And so, you know, the kind of stuff that, you know, commentaries and post-mortems, you know, maybe you could tie into looking back at the development process if you've got that kind of access, stuff like that. I mean, those are the sorts of things that I think in the print media are really essential, because this instant reaction, you know, review score up as quick as the embargo goes down stuff, that's for online. The niche for the print media should be, you know, this kind of more contemplative, sort of reflective look at the less tangible, the less quantitative aspects of the game, and how it's, you know, how it has been received in the gaming community over a period of time rather than just on launch day.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's always more, 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 faster, 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 move on to the next game. It's almost become a grind now. The fact that I'm really even sitting here complaining about my backlog, really, it shouldn't matter. Because if I play a game from 2 years ago, it doesn't make that game any better or worse than any game I would play right now, right? Theoretically.
Right.
It shouldn't matter. You know, I should be able to put up a review of Mass Effect and there shouldn't be anybody in the comment thread saying, oh, what are you saying? This game came out 2 years ago.
Actually, if you put up a review of Mass Effect, I would say that in the comments thread.
Well,
of course you would.
But again, don't call it a review. Make it a blog post and nobody will say anything.
Yeah.
Know?
I think that's why you have blog posts are so prevalent now.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess the question is, in terms of this idea of that Adrian raises about, you know, will the perceptions of gaming from the outside change once you've got this kind of more thoughtful kind of criticism of the medium? I think it's going to change inside first, basically.
Yeah.
You know, that people's expectations about what games give you and what criticism of games, hence, is supposed to give you, is going to have to change first. And then, you know, it's a supply and demand situation. You know, once there's more games that kind of merit this kind of criticism coming out, that people are actually buying and they want to read about in that kind of way, and then that will be supplied more, and so it goes on. And then you might get some change on the outside.
Well, I think where the industry took a big step forward was probably, I mean, really with the release of the Wii, I mean, people had all these access to older games. I mean, typically the industry has been one where older games were actually devalued because everything is so tech-driven. It's, you know...
Yeah, it's obsolete.
Exactly.
You know, it's irrelevant now because everything is inarguably better because it's more technically proficient. Which
is Blaster Master is definitely not obsolete.
Exactly. Yeah, and you're seeing the rise even of sites, even like in the PC arena, you're seeing the rise of sites like, I think it's Good Old Games, GOG.com, where they actually take these old PC games, which people are, I mean, completely off the map. Nobody cares about them anymore. Repackage them and introduce them to a brand new audience. So I think you're seeing more of that. And I think as you see more of that, as people see the entire spectrum of games from way back in the 80s, that those games still mean something. You know, and can also kind of trace like the games that they're playing right now and trace them all the way back to the 80s. I think you'll see critics become a little bit more in-depth in terms of kind of where things are placed in history.
And John, you talk about the Wii in terms of Virtual Console, but I think a whole other side of it is the whole Blue Ocean thing, in that now you've got all these kinds of games available on Wii that really defy the traditional review.
Yeah.
And the people who are buying them often aren't familiar with the traditional game review and don't care about it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not going to that as a source for criticism.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's say a house mom who recently had a baby and wants to drop some of that pregnancy weight is interested in some of these exercise games that are available on Wii. She has a Wii. She's just not sure which one to get. She's not going to go to Metacritic, and she's probably not even going to come to our website and click on reviews and look and see what we gave to these games. We might not even have reviewed these games for very good reasons, you know?
Yeah.
But there are sources for her online to figure it out, you know, to make an informed decision. And they're not called reviews, and they probably don't have a score at the end. Their blogs, their podcasts, their forum threads.
It's true, because I mean, you look at that sort of thing, and you, whether it's from a blog or from a formal review or whatever, is even more on the product recommendation side with some of this stuff. You know, it's because it isn't about so much about a kind of creative experience, so much as it is delivering a kind of a service that you want from a game. So you've got a kind of tension at both ends. You know, you've got your sort of heavy reins of the world that are testing the ability of the conventional review. You know, if you spit that into the traditional review machine, is it really going to evaluate it on the most pertinent levels that game needs to be evaluated on? But then you've got the same problem at the complete opposite end of the spectrum with your sort of EA Sports Actives of the world as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's a good sign that games are becoming harder to quantify. I mean, it really shouldn't be something that you can quantify. And as gaming as a medium expands and gets weirder and more inclusive, you know, and it searches for these corners of what we can even consider a game, it really just shows that the traditional review format often does not apply. And I think one of the telltale signs is that you've even seen pretty traditional websites like ours, for instance, where we started off trying to do a review of Wii Fit and couldn't really figure out a way to make that work. And so we ended up doing an editorial and then later a blog. And then when a successor type game like EA Sports Active comes out, we don't even attempt to review it. We just go in and do like, I did like a week and a half worth of workout reports on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably makes more sense as a, you know, a format to talk about that kind of game. And essentially, I am reviewing it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just not doing it in the traditional format.
Let's break down the graphics on the sound. It really isn't, I'm not saying that it's unfair to criticize the visuals and the sound design in those games, but, you know, in terms of like having them as separate categories and all that, it's just a paradigm that doesn't really apply to that
right.
kind of software.
Well, the next email is from Dan, who writes, "It seems so natural to look at the Wiimote / Nunchuck combo as a keyboard and mouse, as analogous to a keyboard and mouse. I think a dungeon crawler like Diablo or Torchlight would work extremely naturally on Wii, but I can't imagine that actually happening, because a game like that seems dissonant with the accepted perception of Wii owners being grandmas, six-year-olds, and mostly casual gamers. The other type of games that I don't see existing on Wii are games like Batman Arkham Asylum, Mass Effect, or Bioshock. Games that are immersive because of their plots, the distinctive construction of their worlds, and ultimately, the gamer's role in affecting that world. The Metroid Prime series comes close to that level of immersion, but it seems to lack the interesting plots, settings, and characters that keep me glued to the games I enjoy most. I think those kinds of games, particularly Bioshock, are on the forefront of the industry in terms of progressing video games into a respectable medium for telling stories with depth, and with literary elements like dealing with the human condition, society, etc. While Nintendo doesn't seem to care greatly about that type of progression in gaming, where the experiences are more relatable on a personal, maybe emotional, but definitely more internal level, Nintendo has pushed the industry in terms of physical relatability, which can also immerse a player in a game, because there's more levels of interaction that the game has with the game world. Do you think Nintendo will merge these levels of immersion in the future to make more games where the player's interaction with and relation to the game world is significantly more than physical? And do you think this will happen in the Wii's lifetime?"
It depends on how you look at immersion to some extent, because he kind of touches on the different kinds of immersion in there.
Yeah, it's a complex subject.
Because he talks about, the plot immersing him in a game, in something like Bioshock and all that. That's mm-hmm. not something I've often felt, and some of that's the kind of games I play, and some of it's my tastes. But also, I don't know, a plot is not something that makes me feel involved in the game. It makes me feel like I'm watching it. It kind of makes me feel a bit apart from it, a dense plot. Like Super Metroid, which essentially has no plot, of any consequence. I mean, it's really basic, and there's no dialogue or anything like that. That's immersive to me because it's so kind of minimalist that it's a lot easier to sort of transpose myself into the game.
Well, yeah, I mean, in most games, you don't personally make the narrative. You kind of take part in spaces between the narrative.
I would agree.
I like both. I mean, I like the Metroid style where it's really kind of left up to your interpretation. It's left for you to fill in the blanks. And the story is almost in how you play the game or how you perceive what little there is to go on.
Yeah.
But I like stuff like Mass Effect 2 where there's a lot of talking, there's a lot of writing, and there is very much a story there. And I think the only caveat for me is that I don't like sitting through 30 minutes of cutscenes. I don't like the Kojima style Metal Gear Solid stuff where you're literally watching.
How
the
can that be immersive? I mean, surely
that's
taking you way out of it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a pacing issue. It's not a showstopper. You can have cutscenes as long as they're short, and you should probably try to avoid cutscenes when possible. When it's possible to put the player in control of what's going on. Uncharted's pretty good about this as well.
Mm-hmm.
But, when you can show a key story scene, but the player's still in control of it, that is very, very effective. And it really can draw the player into the plot of what's going on. And it doesn't feel like you're just watching it happen. It really does feel like you're participating in it.
Yeah, I mean, I think on the Nintendo side, they've never been a lot about plot. I mean, right. that has never been what they do. We know that Miyamoto's out there with an axe that's got plot's name on it. And he's going to chop it out of whatever he can find.
Well, that's a bit overstating it, because certainly Miyamoto's own games don't seem to have much plot in them. But he has shown some interest in working with other companies. You know, he did work on the Twin Snakes,
which is a very
plot-heavy game, probably too much. And I think the better case is Eternal Darkness, which has a distinctive, unique plot that is memorable, is not like anything else Nintendo has done. And, you know, I mean, the gameplay is handled in a very Nintendo way. You can feel Miyamoto's hands all over the game design and the controls and the mechanics of the game. But he allowed the Western developers at Silicon Knights to keep the plot heavy, you know, the story heavy, the immersive parts of what they brought to the table. So I think Miyamoto is capable of working with other companies and kind of matching his strengths with the strengths of
I think the collaboration aspect I could see, you know, as more of a viable venue. Because otherwise, he seems to be, as has been talked about, like, you know, the Galaxy sort of stuff was kind of snuck in there under his nose, and he's making sure it's not going to get in there in the second one or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess he probably has a feeling that there's a time and a place for it, you know, and Mario at least certainly isn't one of them. But yeah, you look at Zelda, and they're kind of stories is not an insignificant part, but they always seem to be like quite cavalier about, you know, issues like continuity and all this kind of stuff, and like, you know, having the stories be very similar in the different chapters. It's just like a lot of the time it seems like they start with the premise for the game, and then all the story stuff is very secondary.
Yeah, maybe this is a stereotype, but I think that might be you can chalk up some of that to just Japanese culture.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean,
I'm not an expert on Japanese culture, but it's, you know, it seems like intricate plotting, and it seems like repeating well-worn stories
or like myths
is very acceptable.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think, but having said that, you know, you look at some of the things they've done, you know, something like Wind Waker and all, I still think that was very successful on the storytelling level. So, I mean, they have their moments. But they seem very married to certain conventions. You know, the silent protagonist stuff is still very much, you know, the reticence to embrace voice acting on virtually any level. That they have a comfort zone internally, and I think if you wanted them to push beyond that and get to a more sort of, you know, story-driven immersion place in the future, it's going to take the enthusiasm and quite possibly expertise of an outside studio that would be married to Nintendo's oversight, probably.
Well, I think a lot of that has to do as well with kind of the game engines that Nintendo uses. I mean, the Wii is not like a PS3. It can't have the sort of seamless go between, you know, the cutscenes and gameplay like you could in, like, say, Uncharted 2 or something like that. But I think that Nintendo, I think their big thing is that they never want to take the player out of the game to divert them over to something else and then bring them back in. They want it all to be seamless. So I think that at the point that Nintendo gets something maybe as powerful or more powerful than, you know, the HD consoles are right now, I think that you will see them do perhaps more cutscenes and stuff like that, but it won't be an aside from the gameplay. It'll be part of the gameplay and incorporated in.
They're very, I mean, look at their sort of like great concern about load times that they've demonstrated over the years. You know, they're very particular about interrupting the flow of the game.
Mm-hmm. I remember when Star Fox 64 came out, they really made a big deal about the fact that it had real-time cutscenes and that you didn't have to switch off to watch a movie, that everything was done in the engine, that the characters were the same during gameplay as they do during the story scenes. And yeah, I mean, Nintendo has a strong history of supporting that.
And of course,
because
that was the era where, you know, there would be severe discontinuity because, you know, you wet triggered some god-awful FMV movie or whatever on the, you know, the early PS1 and Saturn games. And it was just...
Well, you know, to get back to Dan's question, I don't know about during the Wii's lifetime.
No.
But I do think, you know, Nintendo has asked a lot of its fans, this generation to get outside of our comfort zones and to try things that we haven't done in games before. And I think it's fair for us to turn that back to Nintendo and say, well, Nintendo, we love what you do, but it's time for you to try some things that you're not necessarily comfortable with. It's time for you to take some risks that, you know, you're not really sure of how it's going to turn out. And it's okay for you to copy some elements from Western games or maybe from even some of your, you know, counterparts at Capcom and Konami. Mm-hmm. You know, it's okay to merge some of these ideas that you haven't used in the past.
But one thing I want to pick up on is this, you know, he talks about the physical immersion and the emotional immersion. So we've got plot and kind of motion controls coming together here, kind of is what Dan's talking about. Is could that happen? And it's an interesting idea because I find it a little difficult in some ways to see if that might, those two might not be quite mutually exclusive, but it might be a really difficult marriage to make. Because if you look at something like, you know, if you're used to experiencing a certain kind of cinematic narrative, right, and you're used to doing that in a passive way, obviously, if it comes down to, you know, you actually making like physical gestures during this, I don't know whether that kind of takes you out of the narrative cinematic part. You know what I mean? Like people often say when they're doing stuff on Wii or whatever that it kind of makes them feel a bit silly or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether if you've got that kind of element in there alongside what's supposed to be a really absorbing plot and characters and all that, whether those two things are a tough match to make. I mean, like I said, I haven't seen examples of this, so I can't tell you whether it could be done or not, but Heavy Rain actually has some of this stuff in it. I mean, does it have stuff like six-axis stuff for like shaving? And we, you know, like it does some of this stuff that in a way, so we might find out whether it can work, without being sort of like awkward.
I was just reminded of, Milo and Kate, that demo that Lionhead, that Peter Molyneux put together for Project Natal, he's trying to combine some kind of emotional engagement, you know, between the player and an on-screen character, which is, I think, in the realm of what Dan is writing about here, where, you know, you really get involved in the story and the characters and the writing and what's going on there, but you're combining that with physical gesture kind of control where you're interacting with these characters. And
vocal,
I've always
thought,
ever since that demo was first shown, I thought it was pretty difficult to bridge that gap. So I'm kind of in agreement with you here, Greg. I think it's difficult to combine motion controls or gesture controls with that kind of immersive storytelling. I think it's hard to do.
Maybe it just takes getting used to. You know, in your mind, those two things, like being physically active while taking in a great, you know, narrative, are two things that just don't go together in your mind because you haven't done them. You know, it just hasn't been done before. And so it feels wrong. But, you know, if something comes along, whether it's for Natal or the PS3 motion control or even Heavy Rain right now, and does it and it works for you, you know, your expectations might change. I mean, I don't want to be too closed off to the possibility, but I think it'll be an awkward transition at best.
Right. All right. Well, we're going to wrap up the show now. And in case you're wondering, James is fine. He's just quiet and tired. He didn't get dropped like he did last week. So, that's going to be the end of the show. Thanks everybody for writing in. You can send your emails, and we do have some really cool ones that I'm looking forward to getting to in the future. You can send your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And I thank our brilliant listeners for their wonderful questions that keep us talking every week. That's it for this episode of RFN. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Later.
Bye-bye.
It pretty much looks like an N64 game, but in a good way.
Yeah.
Yeah, like at the end of the game, I don't know if it's the game over screen, or I think it might be the when it shows you your score at the very end of the game, it rates you. Like,
oh,
I think
yes!
I was a muscle. I was like the third. I was like a muscle prince or something like that.
I'm always buff.
And it's like there's like 20 different rankings you can have, from like muscle god or like muscle master or something, all the way down to like whatever, I don't even know.
Yeah, I usually get like muscle master.
Yeah, but on that screen in the bottom left, there's like a squirrel or something telling you game over. And it's it's a squirrel, and it has, like, you know, its head just, like, moves back and forth. And it's just a static picture of a squirrel.
He's shaking his head. He can't believe
it. They did that with the penguins and the peacock, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, I said peacock in reference to this game. What are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
And you can play as a polar bear. Let's just make that abundantly clear.
A polar bear who's packing, apparently.
That's right. He's a beast.